Welcome to Odyssey. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient and modern mysteries all across the globe. We have a very exciting show for you tonight. One of the main topics I discuss and have made films about is the Anunnaki and all of this mythology surrounding the gods. So we have an exciting author with us tonight. First, I want to remind you that this show is somewhat tied into the TNT News, and that's right on your website. If you click on TNT News, you'll get all the great news headlines of the day, and we will discuss several major stories at the end of the show. So I'm going to introduce right now Dr. Rita Louise. She's written a fantastic book. It's called Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. Welcome to the show from Texas, Dr. Rita Louise.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Thank you very much. Well, your book is a great match for my show. The first question I have, I read the book, and you talk a lot about history is often wrong. Now, we grew up in school reading, for example, that Christopher Columbus is the first European to discover America. Not so. Why don't you tell us the real story?
Well, I mean, that's what we're told, and that's what we believe, but you know, it's interesting, and actually I'm going to frame this in a different way. When I give presentations on the book, one of the things that I'll ask a group of people is who discovered America, and I'll get some Christopher Columbus, and then I'll get a couple of people that will say the Vikings discovered America, and maybe one or two people will say, well, what about the Native Americans? Weren't they here first? But then I'll ask the people that have these alternative answers, but wasn't the first thing that crossed your mind Christopher Columbus? Because we were just so programmed into believing that that is the correct answer, and we have to kind of override the programming that's there. And I think a lot of the things that we believe that came from history, like the Egyptians were the first great civilization, we have to override with some of these new findings that are coming out through archaeology and anthropology and people that investigate things like ancient astronauts.
Right. So just for the record, there's pretty solid evidence the Vikings were here a few hundred years before Columbus, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, we did have recorded history. We had the Library of Alexandria, but it burned down to the ground on a couple different occasions, I believe. Why don't you tell us what was in that library, what ancient manuscripts, and what happened to that library?
Well, I mean, I don't know what ancient manuscripts were in there. I don't think anybody knows what ancient manuscripts were in there. But one of the things that when the Greeks were in charge of Egypt, because Alexandria is in Egypt, they were getting people to make copies of all of the important documents, you know, historical documents, scientific documents, and they were being filed and put into this Library of Alexandria. And so it was kind of like going to the, the U.S. Library of Congress. You know, that had this stockpile of ancient texts. And so when that burned down, and there are a number of different conspiracies as to why it burned down, you know, whether it was intentional or accidental, but when it burned down, all of that ancient knowledge was lost. And a very similar thing happened in China. And the same thing happened in the Americas when the Spanish came. They took all of the Mayan documents, which there were apparently thousands of them, and burned them all. And there are four surviving codexes that came from the Mayan people, which is sad because all of their history and all of their culture was burned.
Right. Now, my next question has to do with the Council of Nicaea. Why don't you talk about what documents were compiled into the official Bible in 325 AD?
Okay, well, the Council of Nicaea was a group of priests, bishops that were convened by Constantine to create a more formal Bible. And so there were a number of books that were, you know, put up for inclusion, and you know, there were, and not all of them made the cut. Many of them, you know, we know now as the Apocrypha, such as the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Thomas. Some people say the Book of Enoch was one of the other ones that was eliminated. Many of those texts dealt with things that today would be considered more of a Gnostic text. You know, they went into things like reincarnation. You know, the Gospel of Mary clearly shows, you know, the power of women that, you know, if you want to be a patriarchal society, we don't want those pesky women getting in the way. And so they were just eliminated and identified as being heretical. And so having copies of them were, you know, they were banned from the church, basically. And so there was a splintering that happened with a group of people that kind of went off to the side and became like the Coptics and some of these other Christian but not Catholic at that point in time groups.
So now the Book of Enoch deals pretty extensively with giants. Do you believe that's why it was suppressed?
But see, the Book of Enoch really doesn't deal with giants at all. It doesn't really even mention giants. The Book of Enoch talks about Enoch being taken up into the heavens, where he is taught about the movement of the planets and the movement of the stars, and he's taught a bunch of information. I mean, one of the things the Book of Enoch does discuss is the cause of the flood, but it does not necessarily talk about them as being giants, even though I do think giants were on the earth prior to the flood, but it doesn't identify them as being giants. I mean, there is a book called the Book of Giants that exists, you know, and then there's the Book of Jubilees. I mean, there's so much literature out there that keeping them all straight is kind of hard.
That's why you're here, Doctor. Now, this belief in like an eternal hell that really kind of scared people, was it brought in by the Catholic Church around this time of the Council of Nicaea?
Well, in Judaism, and we can use that as kind of our guiding post, in Judaism, they do not have a belief in hell. In many other cultures, they have a belief in an underworld where the soul of the dead goes. You know, so in Greek mythologies, it would be Hades, or in India, it is Patella. You know, and some fortunate individuals get to go and live with the gods in the heavens, but the majority of people would go into this underworld. And depending on the culture, sometimes that was where you would go kind of in between lives, because many of these cultures also had a belief in reincarnation. And so they would go into this underworld in that in-between time to be, you know, to come back to live on the planet again. But it was not this place of, you know, torment and punishment that is currently believed in the Catholic Church. I mean, that's a much newer concept.
Right, and that really suppressed a lot of inquiry and different ideas, and it scared people. So why don't we talk about the Dark Ages? When exactly did they occur in history, and what was life like during the Dark Ages?
Well, it wasn't good. I mean, what the exact date is, I don't have off the top of my head. I would say, you know, I mean, Rome fell about 400 AD, and so things really changed. With them not being in power. And so, you know, but the Roman Catholic Church had taken control, you know, or Rome became a Catholic state. And so, you know, things really changed. And so as we moved into the Dark Ages, the church started to exert its control over the population. And so if you were identified as being some kind of a heretic or thinking outside of the box, you were annihilated, you know, you were banished, you were killed, you were something. And so it was in your best interest to just listen to
the state, the church and the state.
Right. You know, it was in your best interest to just do what they say. You know, and education really wasn't a priority. And so they just did what they did. You know, and so society was just really suppressed in the general sense of the word, with religion controlling everything that was going on.
Right. Now, Christianity at one point came up of a date of 4004 BC as the creation of the earth. How did this come about? Because obviously that's you're going to prove tonight that that's wrong.
Well, there was a gentleman by the name of Usher who went through the Bible. And, you know, if anyone has read the Old Testament of the Bible or even part of it in the earlier parts, it says, you know, like this person begat that person and you know, they begat this person and they had four sons and their four sons were this and this and this. And the oldest one was this and he married this person and they begat these sons. And so what he did was he took all of the people in the Bible and then you know, picking a start point from somebody that had a known date and counting backwards, he arrived at that 4004 BC date.
Right. Now, just to give an example of how that's wrong, I want to move over to Eastern Europe and talk about when the Bosnian pyramid, the date that that was built. That's a new finding. Why don't you talk about that? Because that's before 4004.
Well, actually, there's actually new dating, but I'm going to make, well, never mind. The Bosnian pyramid, so the most recent, so the original dating on it was about 12,000 BC. But there's actually more recent dating that came out this past summer. And I'm friends with Sam Osmanagash, who is the, you know, founder of the pyramid and the guy in charge of the whole thing. And so this past summer, they actually, as part of their dig, they found, so this was after I wrote the book, as part of their dig, they found a leaf underneath all of the dirt, just on top of the surface of the pyramid. And so, you know, that tells you it's all the way down underneath all of those layers of sedimentation. And so the dating of the leaf was 24,000 BC.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I was like, that works for me personally.
Now, and a lot of people don't know there's pyramids in Eastern Europe, so this is really important. People look into the Bosnian pyramid. And let's talk about Turkey. What was found in Turkey recently, the past few years?
Well, in Turkey, there's a place that's called Göbekli Tepe, where it is a complex. Now, if you listen to the mainstream people, you know, it's for religious purposes only. But it's a large complex, and it has these, you know, I want to say buildings, these circular enclosures. And so there are these circles of rocks, and inside of these are these monoliths. So think of the uprights at Stonehenge, but make them be a lot skinnier. I mean, they look not much wider than like a 2x4. I mean, they're you know, so as thick as a wall. You know, they're not very thick, but they go up 14 feet and they have kind of a T on the top. And what's interesting is that these monoliths are, you know, pretty nicely carved down, and there's carvings of different animals. One of them actually has something that looks like a human carved onto it, snakes, different animals all over these things. And one of the things that's, and it was dated to about 9,000, 9,500 BC. One of the things that they can't quite explain was around 7,500 BC, 8,000 BC, it was covered up. Now, it wasn't just one circular structure. I mean, they have so far uncovered like 16 of these, you know, that were all kind of connected or next to each other into this very large, you know, multiple football field size area. And so they're not even a third of the way done excavating this location. And so it's going to be very exciting to see what else comes out from this site.
Well, I know there's animals on some. Are some of them extinct animals? Would that help us with the dating?
It does not appear that they have like any dinosaur type things on them, you know, or saber-tooth tigers or mammoths that I have seen.
Okay. Now let's jump over to Greece. Tell us about the Greek writings authors like Homer and the Iliad, and were these mythology, or specifically in regards to the Trojan horse, was Troy an actual city?
Well, I mean, that's the thing that's interesting, is when you look at mythology, most scholars will take myth as a whole and say that they're just a flight of fantasy. They're made up stories and from somebody's imagination. And they said the same thing about Homer's work talking about Troy. But then there is a gentleman named Henry Sleamer who went and, using Homer's work, started to investigate areas in Turkey and indeed found Troy. And so what was once identified as being fantasy or fiction now proved out to be something that was true and real.
So the Trojan horse episode may likely well have happened.
At least aspects of it. I mean, Troy is a real city. You know, there is, you know, people that are in it, stories that are in it, they, you know, they have information about them from other places, not just from that story. You know, but just them finding Troy. I mean, it's interesting because when you look at biblical stuff, it is very challenging for them to find many of the places that are identified in the Bible, you know, especially when you get into the earlier Old Testament. You know, like, they think they might have found the location of Sodom and Gomorrah, but they're not really sure. They're not finding the level of devastation that they thought, you know, this rain of fire and brimstone would have. But with the location of Troy, they feel very confident, and it was destroyed, you know, and the one of the walls by the gate was indeed knocked down, you know, so some of the narrative that we find in that story have proved to be true.
So tell me when the main Greek writers were, like Plato and Homer, were writing, and were they referring to the Titans and the gods? What were they referring to, do you believe?
Well, I mean, many of the Greek writers were writing about 300 BC in that area. You know, when they're talking about the Titans, I mean, they were talking, you know, the Titans were a group of gods that existed in our prehistory, you know, and I believe that what they were talking about were actually living, breathing beings and not the forces of nature or something that was imaginary, like they think of it, of Troy in that way.
I agree with you. So now let's get into a little bit of science. Tell me, like, let's go back millions of years. And in your book, you say the first signs of life on this planet were 3.8 million years ago. Why don't you talk about what life was like on the planet Earth at that time?
Actually, that would be billion years ago.
Billion, excuse me.
That's okay. Well, one of the very first forms of life on the planet was just, you know, single-celled algae, blue-green algae. You know, where that really comes into context with this whole narrative is that we identified that I have to back up this whole story. One of the things that we talk about in Man-Made, the Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, is that we look at mythology, and mythology laid out a timeline as far as what our prehistory was. And so this timeline, the myths based on this timeline identified that there were a group of gods that came to the earth. And I'm summarizing in the book, I just share the myths. But in order to kind of not tell every single story, I have to kind of summarize things and put in some of my belief, because this is what I took away from it, that a group of gods came to this earth in something that was identified as the cosmic egg. And actually, we don't believe they came to the earth. We believe they went to Mars first. And there was a destruction event that happened where Mars lost part of its atmosphere. And so a group of renegade gods, the Titans, came to the earth and set up shop. And they did this about 3.8 billion years ago. Now, what was interesting is that was when the destruction event was happening on Mars, And scientists can't figure out how life started on this planet. Just, you know, the idea of, you know, miscellaneous chemicals in a pond getting hit by lightning. And yeah, they've identified it will create amino acids, but it doesn't create living cells. And that's, we don't find this evolution to a living cell. We just find these living cells in the form of blue-green algae on the planet 3.8 billion years ago.
Right. Was the next major event the Paleozoic era? Would that come next?
No. I mean, there are a bunch of other eras that happen.
Okay. Then why don't you take us up to the next major development?
Okay. You're like wanting to be real specific, and I'm like,
Well, we talk about the 7 days of creation in the Bible. Maybe you can relate it to that in Genesis. In your book, you talk about the first day and the second day. So maybe we could refer to that.
Okay.
If you want to go general, go ahead. I tend to be a very specific interviewer, but go ahead and go general and explain it your way. It's your book, so go ahead and
Well, I mean, you know, it's just like too detailed, and, you know, that means I have to have all these facts, and I don't really want to put out facts that I don't have in my hand.
Right, right. Why don't you just talk about it generally then?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we found was okay. I have to kind of think of where I'm going to go with you. Once the Titans were here, okay, so basically, once they got here, they set up shop. And we believe that they worked on developing life here on the planet. And so it's interesting because the first group of gods that came here were these fertility gods, and they are often identified as being half man, half fish, half man, half snake, half man, half some reptilian kind of creature. And so we believe that, one, they brought these early forms of life to the earth, but then with that early life, they started to develop more advanced life forms. You know, I think that there was a combination between evolution as well as, you know, the hand of God at work in the development of the planet, you know, of life on the planet. I mean, because we had a planet that was basically, you know, filled with carbon dioxide, and we could not support life as we know it without having oxygen. And so we believe that they were going and, you know, helping life to develop. And so we have life that develops under the water, you know, the fish and the animals that are under the water. And then it starts to evolve again. I don't know. I mean, I could just keep going, and I'm not feeling very comfortable. So why don't you just go ahead and ask a different question?
Okay. How about the age of the dinosaurs and how you feel they became extinct?
Okay. I mean, you know, 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs were on the planet, and a comet, at least this is the best information they have today, that a comet went and crashed into the Gulf of Mexico, and, you know, there is a crater there, and created a giant explosion that left iridium around the planet, which is how they found this impact point. And created a situation where there wasn't enough light and, you know, photosynthesis happening to sustain dinosaur life on the planet. You know, there are some people that contend that it was an extinction event that wiped out some of the extraterrestrials that were on the planet, but it nonetheless got rid of the dinosaurs. And actually, there are some people, some modern ufologists, that make the statement that even with the dinosaurs, that there were some sentient dinosaurs, and these sentient dinosaurs, this is not in the book, these sentient dinosaurs went underground and lived underground.
I see. So what about the Adam and Eve event of the Bible, the Garden of Eden? Where would you place that in the timeline?
Well, I mean, you know, the placement of man into this whole story is a much more contemporary item. If I had to place it, I would put it about 2 million years ago. Between okay. 3 and 1.5 million years ago. 1.5 million years ago is me being extremely conservative. It's more like 2 to 3 million years ago. There is some evidence that we feel supports this notion. From a biblical point of view, there is a – when Adam and Eve are kicked out of the Garden of Eden, God makes little fur clothes for them to wear. One of the other things that we learned from different mythological narratives is that God, the gods, provide us with – different tools, different information. And so, you know, it's interesting because people that talk about the ancient alien phenomena, you know, will often make the comment, oh, well, you know, the intervention started about 40,000 years ago with Neolithic man, or it started 100,000 years ago because I don't even know why they say 100,000 years ago, but I've heard that number thrown around a lot. But if you look strictly at the mythological record, one of the things that is very clear is that the gods taught us to use fire. And so if you take these number of different factors into account, that takes you back to at least 1.5 million years ago. At that point in time, we were able to walk upright. We had the ability to speak because there were a number of these, and I'm going to say freak, miraculous genetic, you know, changes that happened to us that gave us the ability to verbally communicate. We had the use of fire. We had advanced tool use, stone tools, but advanced tool use. We were starting to live in social groups and create society as we know it. And so it is with the rise of Homo erectus that most of the things that we see as the precursors to civilization were all intact. So were Adam and Eve prior to Homo erectus? It's possible. You know, prior to Homo erectus, we were using tools. We were walking upright. We were hairless for part of that time, you know, so there were factors that were congruent with some of this, but where they all come together is with Homo erectus. And so that's why we put it there conservatively.
Okay, so why don't you talk about creation myths around the world? There's the Enuma Elish, perhaps, or different cultures and how they believe a similar myth of creation.
Well, I mean, when you start looking at creation myths from around the world, one of the things that you find is that they all tell pretty much the same story. You know, the names are changed, but the narrative is all very similar. Now, one of the reasons we believe the names are changed is that in many of these cultures, the names that we have for the gods are more like their titles. So, for example, in Greek mythology, the earth mother is Gaia, you know, but Gaia means earth. In Mesoamerica, there is a goddess called Ciclalique, and that translates as earth mother. And so many of the names we have are more titles associated with them versus Fred or Joe. And so I don't think we actually know these gods' names, but more the description we have of them. And those descriptions are what came down to us as their names. And so when we started writing Man-Made, the Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, that We started in a really interesting spot, and there's a whole lot of reasons that I won't go into, but investigating flood narratives. And I had known prior to this that there were at least 250 flood stories from around the world. Other people have much higher numbers. I'm not going to contest. I've heard 500, 600 flood stories from around the world. I mean, I have not investigated all 500 or 600, have not found 500 or 600, but I'm not going to contest it. But one of the things that we did discover is that when you start looking at these flood narratives, the stories are all the same. Now, if I had a flood at my house and I wrote down my flood story, it would be my flood story. And Mike, if you had a flood at your house and you wrote down the flood that you had at your house, it would be your flood story. And so you wouldn't be in my flood story, and my dog wouldn't be in your flood story. And so the narratives inherently would have to be different. But that's not what we find. We find that this flood story that we find in South America is remarkably similar to the flood story we find in Mesoamerica or in Mesopotamia, which is very similar to the flood story that we find in India, which is very similar to the flood story that we find in Australia. And so taken as a whole, we are left with the belief that they're all telling the same story. I mean, I can consolidate the whole flood story into one paragraph. And so with that piece of knowledge, with that, I mean, we were shocked when we realized that there, it was just basically one story that was being told around the world. And so there weren't – the next question we asked with that was, how is that possible? How is it possible that everybody could be telling the same story? And there were only a couple of different scenarios that would work. We like to use Australia as kind of our test case because Australia, they really didn't take on a lot of acculturation from other societies. They're just kind of left out there in the boondocks by themselves. And so if you find things that appear in their culture, you know that they have to be very old or there has to be something else going on. But Australia was populated about 60,000 years ago. So the question we asked is, well, is the flood story 60,000 years old, and could it have, you know, traveled with them to Australia? And so that was kind of our guiding post. If we found stories there, it had to have gone there with them. Or there was a different possibility. And the other possibility was that the stories that we have of the gods are actually their stories about themselves that they shared with us, and we are just sharing their history as we move forward.
I'm speaking with Dr. Rita Louise. Her book is Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. And one question I have is, what about all the similarities between gods, almost like recycling them between Rome and Greece and Egypt and Babylon?
Well, I mean, I think I was just saying that before, you know, they were just all talking about the same people. I mean, in Rome and Greece, you know, the Romans just took on the Greek pantheon and just changed the names. I mean, we don't really find that in a lot of, well, I mean, we find that in local cultures where a different group will come in and incorporate, you know, other groups' pantheons. But I mean, we don't really find that between like Rome and Egypt per se. But we find those similarities going around the world. So, for example, you know, in every culture, there is a sky god. And this sky god is usually identified as being judging people, or, you know, being the judger. And he's always associated with lightning. And he is pretty quick-tempered and angry. And he especially gets angry when people don't pay attention to him. In the same breath, there's always a god that's identified as being a fertility god. And this god is always associated with water. This god is most times associated with the creation of man and mankind. And this god is also identified as being a trickster or not necessarily listening to the status quo and doing things that he feels more conscientious about, which may go against what the other gods want him to do. And so we find that happening all over the world, the same gods appearing with the same descriptions everywhere.
One of the more interesting ones to me is Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. And it appears to me that he may be Enki from Sumeria. Why don't you talk about Quetzalcoatl?
Well, I mean, he definitely is. I mean, Quetzalcoatl, it was a fertility god. Now, I said earlier that fertility gods were identified or associated with that half man, half snake, half reptilian-y kind of thing. And Quetzalcoatl certainly was. He was the feathered serpent. And Quetzalcoatl is also associated with the creation of mankind. He's associated with teaching mankind. And so all of those qualities that we have of the fertility god are incorporated into Quetzalcoatl as in the same way they are with Enki. So there is definitely parallels between the two.
And why don't you explain the Enuma Elish and that stone, very old document, and the story it tells?
Okay, well, the Enuma Elish is a Babylonian creation story. It is believed that it is actually the story that was conceived by the Sumerians. But the most complete copy we have is actually from Babylon, but there are fragments that are much older in date, and it talks about the prehistory. It talks about these gods coming. It talks about, one group of gods or the children of the progenitor gods, fighting with each other for control and power. It talks about the creation of man, and I mean it is our prehistory, because even in that narrative, the creation of man doesn't appear until the sixth tablet. There are only six tablets, so
right. And a lot of these myths refer to a golden age. When do you believe that golden age was, and what was it like?
Well, I mean, according to most myths, the golden age is associated with the first cycle of time on the earth. And so we have put this, okay, and, it gets kind of hard because, there are multiple cycles of time that occur. But Kronos, for example, is associated with the golden age. And we believe Kronos controlled the earth starting at that 3.8 billion years ago. And so that's where we began the golden age in time. And during that period of time, plants just grew by themselves. Well, I mean, plants always just grow by themselves, but they really didn't need tending, and there was always stuff to eat, and life was just very easy. There really weren't a lot of rules, and it was just a good and easy time. But yeah, 3.8 billion years ago.
Right. And then I wanted to touch on the Indian. There's some very, very old documents, the Ramayana, and they talk about a flying craft. Why don't you mention those a bit?
I mean, I think it comes more out of the Mahabharata, but I haven't actually read all of the Mahabharata. But yeah, I mean, in those texts, I mean, actually all cultures talk about, or not all cultures, a lot of cultures talk about these flying crafts. In India, they're called Vimana. In the Mahabharata, they talk about things that are called Sabhas. And these Sabhas are, okay, so in Christianity, God lives in heaven. But a different way of kind of looking at that same statement is heaven is the home of God. That's where God lives. And so in India, where God lives is in these sabhas. Now, these sabhas are described as being these, as big as cities. I mean, they're huge. and they can house hundreds of thousands of people, and there are multiple buildings in them with gardens and plants and trees and animals. But the thing that's very interesting, there's two things that are very interesting. One is that they can move at the will of the owner, kind of like a mothership. And then two, there were five of them. One was in the air, one was under the water, one was deep within the earth. All right, I'm short a couple here, aren't I?
Well, like you said, there's so much knowledge. It's like we're trying to build an airplane in 45 minutes. It's, you know what I mean? It's just we're doing our best, but it's a mountain of knowledge. But one thing I do know is there's a land bridge to India, and that's been found recently, and that's mentioned in those ancient documents for Sri Lanka and India, that land bridge.
Did you read my article about that?
I did not. Why don't you tell me about it?
Okay. I mean, I ended up writing a whole article about Rama's bridge. And it's actually very interesting because I researched that after this book was done. And I'm like, well, when I do version two, I'll include this whole piece. But yes, there is a bridge that they found between mainland India and Sri Lanka. And what's interesting is that in the Ramayana, see, I did read this book. In the Ramayana, it's the story of Rama. And in it, his wife, for a number of reasons, which he totally deserved, his wife was kidnapped by the demon god of Lanka. And so he spends the rest of the story trying to get his wife back. But the demon god of Lanka, I mean, he lives on Lanka, which is this island. And so getting to the island, like he tries to get his troops. Well, actually, I'm going to back up. So Rama meets the king of the Vanir. Now, the Vanar, are these ape men, okay? And he teams up with them to go fight, the demon god of Lanka. Now, you have to back the story up because right before Rama is born, the gods, or Vishnu, goes to the other gods. Now, this was a very interesting narrative. Vishnu goes to the other gods and tells them to go down to the earth and have relations with the apes and bears on the earth. Now, doesn't that sound like a little biblical story that we've kind of heard before?
Sounds like Genesis 6. Yeah.
Anyway. And so they go down, and the offspring of these relations are these demigods. And so Hanuman, for example, was the byproduct of an ape and the god of wind. And so he was fleet of foot, and he could jump vast distances. And there were other gods that their father was a master builder. And so these offspring had all of the knowledge of architecture. And so they helped Rama build this bridge from Lanka to mainland, or from India to Lanka. If I recall correctly, this thing is like 18 miles long. It's huge.
And it's real. It's a real bridge.
And it's real. And they have done core drilling on this site. And what they have found is that there is a layer of sand all the way at the bottom. Then there was a layer of rock. But when they look at the way that the rock is in there, the rock looks like it was placed. And when they assess the rock actually came from the mainland and was put there. And then there's another layer of sand and debris on top of it, you know, because the water over the years has gone on top of it. And so, you know, where I was putting what makes it even more fascinating to me, I was putting the whole Adam and Eve story at about 1.5 million years ago. Well, Rama, according to Hindu tradition, lived during the Treta Yuga, which started about 1.7 million years ago. And so time-wise, he's actually in the right period to have these ape men be around.
So fascinating.
See what I'm getting?
Fascinating. Yeah. I want to bring you way over to Israel in the Old Testament. And when I read it now, I see Jehovah out in the desert for 40 years with the Israelites, spending a lot of time and energy making sure nobody sees him, not even Moses. He hides behind a burning bush. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think that that whole thing was just one giant extraterrestrial encounter. I mean, you read that narrative, you know, and God comes down, you know, when you don't get the description in the first time, but when he goes, you know, and they're out of Egypt and he wants to go talk to the Israelites, you know, he comes down in a giant cloud and lightning and just starts talking to them in a booming voice, which scares the crap out of them. But it just seems like, you know, the way that story comes off, it sounds very parallel to what you find in contemporary UFO encounters. You know, I don't think that God was with them or, you know, that, you know, whoever that was with them every day. I think, you know, they interacted with him. I think that, you know, there was a lot of communication that was happening via the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, because I do believe that that was some kind of communication device. And I think that Moses did a lot of channeling. I don't know. He would always come up with all kinds of good stuff, you know. But it doesn't, when you read it, it doesn't necessarily say God said this. It's like, well, Moses told them to do this. And so whether it was God working through him, whether it was Moses downloading information, it's a little hard to tell.
Right. And I want to ask you, you know, kind of the big giant in this field is Zachariah Sitchin and his interpretations of these old clay tablets. How important was that in your research, and how does your research correlate with his, that story?
I mean, I had read Zachariah Sitchin's work quite a while ago, and we decided in writing this that we were not going to utilize any contemporary authors in the narrative because we found that there was too much opinion and too much BS that we were finding. And, I mean, even with Zachariah Sitchin's work, I would have loved to be able to corroborate the story that he gives. You know, I read every, I mean, unless he has had a library of clay tablets that have not been published or I could not, you know, that are not in print anywhere, I could not find the material that he talks about. Some of it is there, a lot of it I couldn't find. So I'm not going to say it was a bunch of lies, but I could not find it in my research. And I could not find corroboration for much of what he said in myths from other places. And if we could not find corroboration, it didn't make the book. You know, so I've had people make comments to me about, well, you didn't talk about Atlantis. It's like, well, Atlantis only came from one source. If I could find another source that talked about this continent sinking, I maybe would have incorporated Atlantis, but
right,
there weren't any. And so to us, that was the verification. That was the only way you were going to get in the book, is that if we could find a different culture telling the same story or providing, you know, similar facts.
Well, I want to thank you for giving us a wealth of just a fountain of information in a very short time, and I really appreciate it. And the book, once again, do you have a website, or why don't you give out the information one last time?
Okay, so my website is www.soulhealer.com. That's SOULHEALER.com. That's soulhealer.com. And that's kind of the portal to everything Rita Louise. So you can get access to all of my books. I have a radio show. You can purchase my books off of my website. They're all available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods is available in a Kindle format. But if you want to get a signed copy, you have to purchase it directly from me, soulhealer.com.
Absolutely. Thank you for being on the show, and good night to you, Dr. Rita Lewis.
Thank you, Mike.
Good night. Okay, so this is Odyssey, Ancient and Modern Mysteries All Across the Globe. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We have a little more time, so that was great. That was fascinating, and we need more voices in this field. You have some big voices. We have Zachariah Sitchin and Michael Tellinger out of Africa. We have Graham Hancock. We have David Wilcock. Jim Mars, those and Giorgio Tsoukalos and Eric Von Doniggen, those are seven or eight big voices in this field, and they're talking about the most ancient documents and stone tablets and pyramids and structures on this planet. So this is a little more of a scientific background that takes us, you know, back millions and millions of years, and I really wanted to have Dr. Rita Lewis on the program to give you some of that insight and her voice, and let's add that to the field and to the debate, because it's we need to find out, you know, the actual history of our planet, and so I was just a really mind-blowing interview. Anyway, we talk a lot about this show is kind of tied into the TNT news, and that's current events of the day, and it's right on the website. If you scroll down to the middle, you'll see TNT news, and there is just a lot of big stories going on. The one that jumped out at me this week was Joe Biden, our vice president, and he was calling for a new world order this week. And he just came out and said it. You know, we're putting together this new world order, just like George Bush Sr. did all those years ago. And it's really out in the open. And some people think, oh, that's just so such conspiracy. It's just so crazy. It's like you're wearing a tinfoil hat if you believe the Bilderberg Group and these secret groups are creating a new world order. Well, the vice president believes it. So if he believes in it and he's creating it, I think we should too, or at least research it and find out what it is and who the players are and who are the pieces on the chessboard so that we can react accordingly. To give you an example, the European Union did not just occur. You cannot get all the countries in Europe under one umbrella, and they all lost their national sovereignty, by the way. France, England, Greece, they are no longer individual sovereign nations. Everything's a group decision. It's made by council. They've lost a lot of their power, a lot of the local control, and that took decades of planning. And that was not done out in the open, and it was not done with the will of the people. It was supposedly just a trade agreement, but the architects had much more than a trade agreement of the European Common Market in mind, and it was created step by step by step. And there was a researcher who broke the story in the 60s of this happening, this global government being created, the United Nations and the World Trade Organization and all of these groups. And he was Professor Quigley, and he was a Georgetown professor, and he wrote a book. And the powers that be actually tried to suppress it. They broke the when the book is in galleys, it's like they broke like the mold for the book, actually. And it was suppressed for a while, and it was called Tragedy and Hope. But you can get it now. It's on, you know, you can go to Amazon and buy it now. And he had access to all the papers of all of these globalists, and he was a globalist too, and he believed in it. He just wanted it exposed. So it's been well documented now. And so you have the vice president coming out talking about the new world order. So what that means for America is we would no longer be the United States of America. If they have their way, we will be the North American Union, which would be a giant, you know, council, a giant economic zone from the equator up to the North Pole. Canada, Mexico, United States, it would all be just one global economic zone. And so that's where, you know, if you want the U.S. to remain an individual sovereign nation, the Declaration of Independence, a local congressman, a senator for your state, if you want all of that to remain, the Bill of Rights, you have to dig in and fight for it. And and get involved in politics a little bit here and there. And, you know, of course, we're into metaphysics. You know, this is a metaphysical network. But don't be afraid to put your hand in politics, too. And, you know, we can wear all kinds of hats and get involved in this process that's going on. So Alex Jones has really good movies kind of exposing the New World Order, and they're free, and he's released the copyright to a lot of his movies. So if you just go to YouTube and type in Alex Jones, you can get all kinds of free movies. One is called Endgame, and one is called Terror Storm. There's many of them, many of them. So that was a good article that jumped out at me. Greg Braden has a three-hour video that's free online at TNT News. It's a little bit older, a couple years older, but Greg Braden is great. I noticed a lot of people are watching it online. There's 270 people that clicked on that link. So, you know, if you want to see Greg Braden, and he talks a lot about the transformation that we're going through as 2012 has passed and we go into this new age, he's one of the key players. And I've seen him several times. He's very exciting. So the other article I want to point you to is called 50 Ways to Starve the Beast. And by the way, if there's any phone calls, if you want to call in and talk about the author, Dr. Rita Louise, and her book, Man-Made, that's fine. You know, I'll take a call. Or if you want to talk about TNT News, any article that jumped out at you on the homepage here. So 50 Ways to Starve the Beast. I'm clicking that on right now. And it talks about how to, you know, keep control of your life, keep local community control of your life and not be swallowed up by globalism and world giant corporations and such. So number one says grow your own food. And, you know, in America, there's a lot of us that can do that. If you have a backyard, you know, you've got to plant trees anyway. You might as well plant, you know, I was in my last house, I had plum trees and I had all kinds of things, herbs. You might as well, you know, grow something that produces. And even if you just have a windowsill, you can grow herbs and they're easy to use in all kinds of food. So that's number one. Number two is shop at local businesses with no corporate ties. And I'm a big believer in this. I'm a big believer in Main Street USA. Going into your local Main Street and your mom and pop, your restaurant, or your gift shop, or dry cleaners, or what have you. And if you spend $100 at a local restaurant, that money is going to circulate about seven times in your community, because the restaurant owner is going to spend that $100 maybe at the local shoe store, you know, getting shoes. And then the shoe store owner will go down to the next store and spend it. It will just circulate in the community. So that's really important. Use natural remedies instead of pharmaceuticals whenever possible. I believe in that. I believe, you know, herbs have been around for thousands of years, and there's a lot of homeopathic remedies that are quite effective. I'm eating, you know, raw honey every day, a tablespoon, and raw garlic every day, and all kinds of highly nutritious foods. I'm doing a Green Monster, which is a spinach shake in the morning. It's orange juice, spinach, diced up apples, diced up pineapple, and raspberries, a little bit of honey. And so, no, I don't go to Jamba Juice and get all this dairy in my smoothie. You know, you can just do it yourself. And no, I did not buy a $300 blender. I have a regular blender, you know, for $20. And I just do a Green Monster smoothie in the morning. Walk or bike instead of driving whenever possible. I believe in that if you can. Shop at local farmers markets. That's really important. If you just type into Yahoo, you know, farmers markets, let's say you live in St. Louis, okay? If you type in farmers markets St. Louis, you know, you're going to find a lot of listings probably. Where I'm at in Southern California, oh my God, there are probably over 100. There's no excuse if you're in Southern California not to to support these farmers and give them that $20 bill and see the big smile on their face. And that's cash money right there. They can feed their families. Sometimes their kids are right there, you know, with the watermelons and strawberries. And boy, does that food taste better than, oh God, if you try a salad at McDonald's or something, you know, and then you try a farmer's market salad, it's no comparison. This says, you know, don't buy corporate stores like Walmart, Costco, Best Buy, Home Depot. A lot of those products are produced overseas, and we have to be careful about if all of our factories and all of our factory jobs and everything is produced overseas, we're going to have like a giant hole in our economy. So it is important to buy things here that are made here. And another thing is, you know, beyond farmers markets is local arts and crafts. Go to your craft fairs, you know, when Christmas comes, go to your craft, your church bazaars, your craft fairs, and pay that cash right to that artist right there so they can use that money right now, this week. It's great. Anytime you need a gift, you know, find a local artist and support them. And believe me, you'll feel good. Remember, give out vouchers as gifts for an evening of babysitting, a homemade meal, walking the dog, doing a repair or cleaning. Yeah, let's get involved in barter and trade. And there's a lot of good bartering and trading sites right in your, if you go online, you can find them. Type in, like, you know, if you live in St. Louis barter and trade, and you'll find groups. You'd be amazed. You can trade your services. Let's say you clean pools or something. You can trade that for somebody who does babysitting and do a nice barter across the board. You don't have to pay for everything. Number 13, ditch television. Well, I did it. I 6 months ago I moved out to the desert and I did not turn on the cable. I just didn't do it this time. And it was, you know, difficult for like 2 weeks. But it's just better now. It just, life is just better. I am definitely more observant. I talk to more people. I, you know, see the birds, I see the sky. I'm very much more aware of my surroundings and such. And, you know, I'll go to a movie, or I love plays. I'll go to the theater and I'll watch some things on the computer now and then. But, you know, if there's a quality movie out, sure, go ahead and, you know, I'll rent it and I'll play it on my TV and I'll really enjoy it for those 2 hours. I like a good classic film or a good murder mystery or something like that. But you just do it in little bits here and there, and it's a treat, and you really enjoy it. And so I haven't watched commercials in 6 months, and I feel a lot less consumerism. I don't feel the need to buy things like, you know, expensive colognes. Maybe there were subliminals being used, and I'm not seeing the subliminals anymore. I'm not having the feeling to rush out to the store and buy a lot of things. So the next one, number 16, is, you know, go on Craigslist, have a yard sale. It's really important to clean out your environment and move it on. If you haven't used it in a year, then you need to get rid of it. That's the rule, right? So all your clothing and such, that, you know, things you haven't used in a long time, go ahead and have a yard sale and make some money and pay it forward and pass it on to the next person so they can use that clothing or they can use that piece of furniture and they can, you know, it's their turn to put their love into that object, and then they can pass it on. So that's number 16. And once again, I'm on TNT News. That's halfway down the webpage, TNT News. Click it on. The article is called 50 Ways to Starve the Beast. And, you know, if you can post this on Facebook or just print it out and pass it along, it's a fantastic article. So I really appreciate Don and Doug Newsom, the owners of this network, putting this up and all of these stories on TNT News. Number 21, read a book, purchase secondhand or borrowed. Absolutely. You can get used books for almost nothing right now. You know, going to garage sales, estate sales, you can get books for like 50 cents, you know. Attend local free activities, lectures, concerts, plays at the park, library events. There's so many things that are free. I'm a big believer in parks and recreations, and I used to work for Parks and Recs when I lived in Oregon. And anybody can propose a class if you have a skill, like let's say you teach acting or yoga. You can go to your local parks and recs and propose a class, and you can teach it, and you can make money, and it's great. And or you know, I worked for them as an employee, and I think the events were like $3, you know, to play volleyball, or $2. It's just really minimal. And so, you know, get involved in parks and recs, and libraries do have events. They have all kinds of free things going on. And Craigslist has activities and events. If you click on Craigslist, the events page or activities, and that goes hand in hand with, you know, dumping your television and just starting to go out at night in the evening and attending these events and activities. Let's see. Number 30, go camping instead of staying at a hotel. That's a good idea. We have campgrounds all over the United States, and you know, you don't have to stay in a hotel. You can go to a campsite. Reduce electricity usage with candles, solar power, and non-tech equipment. That's 33. Drop the thermostat and put on a sweater. I definitely did that when I lived in Oregon, and I saved a ton of money just putting on, you know, sweats under my jeans and a sweater. You know, it's just so simple, such common sense, but you can save money. Bring snacks and drinks in a cooler when you're out in the car or on a road trip. That would be great for stopping all these cravings and stopping at the fast food places. If you just do something as simple as, you know, raw nuts or dry roasted are the best, healthiest way for like walnuts or cashews or granola bars, and just having those handy. So make, it says make delicious treats for people. You can, you know, bake cookies for people as gifts and put them in a tin. That's so easy to do. And we don't have to be involved in consumerism and always going out and always buying things. You can make it yourself. You can make, you know, vinegars with, you know, garlic vinegar is really easy. There's recipes online, put them in a nice glass jar and, give those out as gifts. I've done that as well. Raise backyard chickens for your own eggs. That's a good idea if you have some land. That's 42. Live in a smaller, more efficient home. There's a really fun website. If you look up tiny homes or miniature homes, there's I think it's called Tumbleweed Tiny Houses. There's all these people who are ditching their big mortgage and, you know, in a big city and just moving out to a smaller city in the country or something, and a smaller home, and they can live in like a yurt, which is a circular home. You can buy a yurt for like $10,000 or $15,000 and have no mortgage, you know. There's gypsy wagons. If you look up a gypsy wagon, a pretty simple home. Some are on wheels. You don't even need a permit or anything. So there's definitely smaller homes and cabins you can live in and simplify your life as well. Collect rainwater for use in the garden. So these are, you know, I didn't hit all of them, but there is many, many good ideas on this list. It's called 50 Ways to Starve the Beast, once again. So that's a great article. And so those were some of the stories that caught my eye on the TNT News. Just a few more points. You know, I talked about going out and living in the country or a smaller town and tying it back into the New World Order. You got to be aware of Agenda 21, because what they're trying to do is get people out of the farmland and out of the country and push them into the city. So do some research on Agenda 21. It was put in place. We signed it back in the 90s. Bush and Clinton signed us into it. And it's being kind of like secretly implemented in communities all across the United States right now. When I was in Portland, Oregon, you know, they always call it sustainable development. Sustainable development, it's good for the environment. But when you really read into it, they feel that all cars are bad. They don't want you driving a car. They want you stacked up in apartments. They don't want you in a house. A single family home is bad, is wasteful. They want you in, everyone's stacked in the city. So that means no more, They don't want you to have like 3 acres of land out on the farm growing your own apples or what have you. But, you know, we're patriots here. We believe in freedom, and this country was founded on farmers and living off the land. And so please, there's good YouTube clips on Agenda 21. Find out about it. Find out what they're doing. And you can talk to real estate agents about it. You can go to your local community meetings and spread the word. And that's the New World Order at work. That's the globalists, the international organizations telling Americans how to use their land. And what they're doing is they're making the zoning harder and harder to build on your farm, to get permits, to have even like parties in your farm or something. You have to have a permit. I mean, there's all kinds of stories. And people just wanting to build like a barn or build an extra cottage on their farm. A lot of this zoning and permitting is being taken away. So I wanted to give you a heads up on that. And there's been good articles on TNT News about Agenda 21. And you're not going to hear about it. You're just going to hear about sustainable development. Oh, this is for the environment. This is saving the world. But that's not what it's about. And if they want to do that, they need to do it out in public, out in the open. And my understanding is it came from 1968, the Club of Rome. And that's where the genesis of this idea came from. And the Club of Rome, if you read David Icke, that's one of the New World Order groups. And the main ones are the Bilderberg Group. I would really look into the Bilderberg Group, how they were created in 1954 and how powerful they are right now and what they're doing. And that's based in Europe, but it's wealthy Americans as well. The Council on Foreign Relations, they totally have inroads and access to the media. They're kind of the link or the bridge to the media, and that's why the media won't talk about the New World Order. They will not talk about the one world government that's being set up because of the Council on Foreign Relations. And some of your favorite newscasters that you grew up with are in the CFR. I'll throw out a few names. Barbara Walters, Diane Sawyer, Ted Koppel, Tom Brokaw, many, many people. Some actresses like Angelina Jolie. So look into the Council on Foreign Relations and what they're doing behind the scenes. They're a private organization. They are not part of our government. They're not elected. I know it sounds like an official name, just like the Federal Reserve is not part of the federal government. That's just an adjective. It's a private bank and private stockholders. And then the other group, globalist group, is the Trilateral Commission that was formed in the 70s by, you know, the Rockefellers. And David Icke is really good in his books. He's a researcher that it's really important to read, you know, one or two of his books or see the Alex Jones movies and find out about who the players are on the chessboard and how the pieces are being moved so that you can react accordingly. So I'll leave you with that thought. And a lot of it's exposed on the TNT News. If you know, I no longer watch corporate news. I haven't watched it since probably 10 years. I have not watched a newscast. So I get my news on TNT. I go to Infowars.com, which is Alex Jones. I go to Rents. RENSE.com, Jeff Rents, is very good. Before It's News is good, beforeitsnews.com. The Universal Seduction is great. The Universal Seduction, that's a great one. So InfoWars again, DavidIcke.com, DavidIcke.com, and TNT News once again. And so I just have my little circle of websites, and I'm getting the raw non-corporate data so I can react accordingly. I can vote accordingly. I can make my decisions accordingly. So I'll leave you with that. I'm going to wind up the show. I appreciate thank you to Dr. Rita Lewis for coming on. And this is my name is Mike Schultz. My website is mysteryislands.net. And if you click on the link, you know, to Odyssey, you'll see more about me. I do tarot card readings. I do them on Skype, on video, or just the regular phone. Either way, I can do a reading for you. I have made 4 films on Ancient Aliens, the Anunnaki. And what I'm doing now is if people get a phone reading from me, I'll give them a free movie. I'll send them out one of my films for free. So check it out. It's on the website. It's mysteryislands.net. And check out my work and my passion. And my passion is, you know, doing radio is my passion. And making films on the Anunnaki is my passion. And tarot is my passion. Among many, we all have gifts in the metaphysical world. And if you're not sure what your gifts are, then, you know, you can explore with a tarot reading or work with the pendulum or work with meditation and work with angels and just listen to these shows and work with dreams, find your guidance. And so I have three specific paths that I'm doing right now, and it feels really good and to be sharing in these three ways. And I want all of you to have that too. So work with all of these tools and find your gifts and then give them out to the world. Thank you for joining me on Odyssey. My website, one more time, is mysteryislands.net. And I'll see you in 2 weeks. Namaste. Have a good night.